Greetings from K9 to Diddly-Dum, Diddly-Dum, Diddly-Dum. End of message.
Day, faithless sisters, and welcome to episode 149 of the Diddly Dum podcast, the fourth best Doctor Who podcast out there. I'm Doc.
I'm Hayden.
And I'm Mark.
We're also due to be joined today by former co-host Mr. Matt Charlton, who expressed a wish to get in on this particular podcast episode. But unfortunately, he's typically for Matt, he's still working. And so you'll jump in.
Will he appear on the Whosian monitor, peering down at us?
Yeah. Right, so what's been happening since last we spoke? I haven't checked my Twitter in the last 5 minutes, so I'm not sure whether at the moment Tony Selby is dead or alive.
Oh my God.
I think Tony's alive. I don't know what that accent was.
It sounds quite Scouse to me, that.
Yeah.
Tony's alive.
Was there another Tony Selby at the BBC or something?
Yeah, I believe so. It's a case of mistaken identity. But what made it worse was the fact that Nicola Bryant then commented and retweeted the misinformation, so it got disseminated around Doctor Who Twitter quite quickly.
Did you ever hear of the great mistaken identity on Celebrity Big Brother once, when I think it was David Bowie had just passed away and David Guest was one of the housemates, but David Bowie's ex-wife was in the house and she said David's died, and one of the house guests absolutely,
oh my God, I was just talking to him in the kitchen. Yeah. And he's dead.
It's only a game show.
Angie and Tiffany are in the kitchen.
Angie, I like your hair.
Thank you, sweetie.
The black ribbons. Are you okay?
I'm fine, honey.
Okay.
And you're looking at me and you are looking deep.
Yeah.
You got it?
Yeah.
You know I wouldn't be in this condition if it was just a cold. Tiffy, you gotta do me a favor.
Anything.
You can't say a word.
Nothing.
David's dead.
No, he's not.
You can't do that.
What the f*** is that?
Are you serious?
Shh, sit down.
Oh my gosh.
Stop it. They're all gonna know. Just happen now.
Wow.
Cancer. And you gotta please stay calm, please.
Oh my gosh. I can't keep this a secret.
Oh, great.
I can't keep it a secret. She told me not to tell anybody.
What's up?
What's happened now?
What's the matter, babe?
Oh, great.
Tiffany. Come sit down. Tiffany, come on.
She told me something, and I have to say it. I'm not able to not say anything.
Sit down.
No, go in the diary room. That's what
I
said.
Sit down. I hope she's just joking, but she says she's not.
That's what you're screaming.
Yes.
What? Sit down, babe. Sit down.
She told me that David is dead.
David.
Yes. She said he just died, and I can't hold this in by myself.
No.
Jesus.
Where's David?
He's fine.
Why the f*** is she saying that?
What the hell?
She told me that David died.
What did I do?
You told her that David was dead with cancer.
Yes, he is.
He's in there asleep.
Oh, David. My ex-husband. What is the matter with her?
Oh, dear. But seriously, Tony Selby, keep safe.
On a slightly more gloomy note, we recently lost Damaris Heyman.
Yes.
Mm.
Yes. But, you know, she had a good, long, exciting life, I think.
I mean, when Mark and I were at Oldbourne in 2019.
Yes.
Not accompanied by Hayden, because he was too busy planning his wedding. I mean, honestly, people just don't care, do they? Call themselves friends. She looked very frail, didn't she? I think she was in a wheelchair at the time.
Was she at the Capitol event that we all attended as well? I seem to remember seeing her there.
I don't remember seeing her any other time apart from at Oldbourne.
Maybe it was the first one then. Maybe she was at the first one. Okay. Yeah.
And if you'll excuse me, a slight tangent away from Doctor Who.
Surely not.
We also lost Norman Lloyd in May, who probably might not mean anything to any of you, but was one of my favourite actors, partly because of my obsession with trying to bring back received pronunciation, because I think we need actors who don't just sod bringing back regional accents. We need actors who, when they speak, it sounds like an avalanche of boulders slowly sliding down a mountainside.
Oh, what a lovely answer. I'm not a man prone to vulgarity, but your ass is already in the grinder here. I suggest you cooperate.
I think he's clearly more of a stage actor than a TV or film actor, which probably explains a lot. I caught him the other day on something that I saw on by accident, and I thought, I'll just check how old he was. So I tapped his name into Google and said he'd died in May 206. He was... I don't think any of you know who he was. He probably most famous for... I think he was the... he played the headmaster in Dead Poets Society. The one that's telling Robin Williams to clear out at the end, where they're all about to stand up on the desks and say bye-bye.
Speaking of accents, we've also lost Dido.
Dido?
Not the singer.
Dido's dead!
Talking to him in the kitchen. No. God, what's the actress's name?
Jackie Lane.
No!
Yeah.
I didn't see that. Dodo.
Yeah.
Dodo, yeah, not Dido.
God's sakes.
Actually, I can't really expect to catch up with the news, because I get hold of a DWM, just took it on the shelf and never read it. When did she die?
Oh, a few days ago, I think. At the time of recording, dear listener.
Oh, how sad.
Yeah.
How old? God, she can't be that old, can she? Mind you, Liz and Mary can't have been that old, can they? And they've,
Well, I don't suppose you remember this. This would be in one of our Whoseum databanks somewhere. But a few months ago, I shared with you two a newspaper cutout of Jackie Lane visiting a primary school in Harlow in Essex in 1966, I think it was. And that was my mum's primary school.
Oh.
So my mum didn't remember it, and she'd only been about 4 at the time. But yeah, so Jackie Lane visited my mum's school. Did a little school fete where she was the guest of honour. Got to do the tombola and read out the raffle prizes, I think. Another thing, slightly happier news, is we've had the new slipcases announced for the Doctor Who Blu-ray collection, which are not only substantially smaller in size, but also, actually, I noticed, almost 10 quid cheaper.
What's pissed me off, you'll be aware, chaps, that I cancelled my orders of the limited edition ones, the big chunky ones that are made of cardboard packaging, and said, oh, I'll wait a year until the slipcases come out. Guess what turned up today? Clearly I'd forgotten to cancel it properly, or I hadn't realised I'd ordered it with someone else.
Oh, season 24?
Yeah.
Oh, right. Yes. I did that too. Because it wasn't through Amazon. Because Amazon, and once again, Amazon have royally cocked up their orders.
Have they?
For the limited, yeah. So I went with HMV back in February, I think, and completely forgot about it until I got an email Monday morning saying, this is on its way. I was thinking, oh, okay, well, all right then. I'll check that out. Which actually reminds me, Mark, you didn't have season 26, did you?
No.
So did you want first refusal on that one?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, cool. Because I decided in the end, I went against the vote on my Twitter page and decided to go with the slipcases. And I have to say, I'm a lot happier for it, actually, with my collection, because they do look a lot better on the shelf next to the other Blu-rays of the new series. Much smaller in design. But yeah, no, I've noticed Zoom as well. I think Matthew Purchase and Pitt Madeley were talking about this on Twitter, that Zoom's back up and running again, and Zoom has the Season 10 and Season 18 slipcase box sets up for pre-order. They're only out on the 5th of July, so by the time this goes out, they will be available again. But they're about £5 cheaper than what they are on Amazon and other places. About 33 quid, I think it is.
Oh, nice.
I thought they'd gone.
No. Well, no, because these ones are just standard editions, so they shouldn't sell out.
No, basically. I thought Zoom had gone bust.
They were picked up by new owners, basically. So, but yeah, no, apart from that, it's my son loves the theme tune. And I was whistling.
Which one?
Well, funny you should say that. We had a family day over here where Sophie's family came down, and then after they left, it was the same day as the Season 12 and Season 19 Blu-rays came, and I put Genesis of the Daleks on. And he stayed on that mat, on his little play mat, for about 5 of the 6 episodes and watched it intently and quite enjoyed it. I mean, I sent you guys the pictures, didn't I? It was quite cute. And then I realised after whistling the theme tune at him, he seems to get quite a big thrill from that too.
Aww.
And the Great Escape theme tune, I've noticed as well. He likes those two.
Oh God, he's not going to grow up into being an England fan, is he?
I thought you were going to say he's not going to grow up to be a little Englander. And I was thinking, no. By Jove, no, he won't.
And if you hear it, you need to say to him, you know that William Russell was in that film, don't you? Ollie Alexander has been rumoured as being the next Doctor. Although his agent apparently has denied it and said, even though Ollie is often contacted by Cybermen, I'm afraid I have to exterminate this speculation. Oh dear, this is a bit punny. As nice as it is to see interest in this story regenerate, it just isn't true. As oud as it may sound, Ollie is focusing on his music for the time being.
Oh, that hurt. That hurt.
I must say, as much as I enjoyed It's a Sin, I found his character more irritating than the others. I didn't particularly remember thinking, oh, what? He's just a splendid actor.
Well, his character is deliberately polarising, isn't it, I think, in that. So that's the...
Yes, I suppose so. Yeah.
Didn't it all just come from an interview that somebody did, somebody at Starburst did with Russell T Davies? And I think it was just a passing comment, wasn't it, about casting a gay actor, and they just kind of like Ollie Alexander or something. And I think Russell T Davies said, ooh, that'd be nice. And then one of the tabloids picked it up and did their thing of saying, oh, look, everyone, Ollie Alexander up for to be the next Doctor. And it was all a load of speculation about very little as far as I can work out.
It's just a load of tabloid twaddle, really. Not that I'd be very, I don't mind, but until someone's cast, it's all just hogwash. I mean, there was a point when David Tennant gave up the role that they thought Richard Hammond was going to be the next Doctor. It's things like that. It's just, I mean, it's nice because it keeps Doctor Who trending on Twitter and it keeps it in the public eye a damn sight more than the current programme itself does. So that's good publicity for it. But there we go. I don't know. I think the trouble is the thing that's really getting to me and has got to me the last few years about social media is just how polarising it is, how there's no straight down the middle, there's no sort of central thinking. It's either you love an idea or you hate it. And if you are on one side of the fence, you're tarnished with a brush. It's like if you didn't want Jodie to be the Doctor, or you don't like Jodie as a Doctor, then you're sexist. If you don't want Ollie Alexander to be the Doctor, then you're homophobic.
Mm.
It's not that at all. It's more... If I actually Ben... Was he called Ben? Ben Daniels or Ben Collins? No. One of the... there was an actor, blonde-haired actor, who was heavily tipped to take over from Matt Smith. I think it's called Ben Daniels. Anyway, he was gay. No one cared. It's just, but he's a good actor. I think the trouble is Ollie Alexander's got his fingers in a few pies. And I said this because my wife said, she's a Years and Years fan. She said, oh, wow, you didn't tell me this. Oh, this is going to be brilliant. I said, no. I said, this hasn't happened. I said, and realistically, the guy is a touring artist. Are you seriously going to tell me that he's going to take a couple of years out of his schedule to just act in a show that takes up 9 months of your life? I don't think so.
It was Ben Daniels.
It was Ben Daniels. Oh, brilliant. God, how did I remember that?
His face doesn't look familiar. What's he been in recently? He was in Law and Order UK as the barrister.
Okay. I think he was in...
Is that a flickering on the scanner?
Ah, Matt's ready.
If he comes in saying, ah, there you are. I seem to be stuck up here.
A freak wormhole has opened up in the fabric of the space-time continuum, and we are now, even as we speak, driving a Skype connection through it from the Hooseum, northwards, ever northwards, to the County Palatine.
Matt, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
I was going to say, I really wouldn't worry about that. I've got construction work, trams, and I'm also going to be boarding a train when I get back to the station, so that's going to be exciting.
Are you walking down the street?
Yes, I'm walking the, what they call the inverted commas, city link from the Etihad back to the station. I thought that would give me a little bit of breathing space of not being on public transport.
Mm.
Season tickets to the Hooseum are not what they were.
Well, it'll entertain the people on the train, I suppose.
Yes, I suppose it will. I have got my own microphone. I've actually got a lapel mic on, don't ask, long story, that I'm hoping will record decent quality of my voice. We'll find out when this is finished.
At some point, listeners, we're going to give clues, Doctor Who clues, posted around the country, in which case Matt is going to hop in a helicopter and jump out and have to solve the puzzle as he goes along.
It's not a treasure hunt, and I don't have a cameraman behind me.
Now, Matt, we've just been, just as you appeared, we were just in the middle of talking about these Ollie Alexander rumours. Now, you know what you're talking about when it comes to Doctor Who. What was your reaction to this?
Right, okay.
If you're worried about sounding rude, I've already said I don't think he's a very good actor, and Hayden said that too, so... Hello?
Sorry, one of my colleagues tried to call me. That's a cliffhanger moment, isn't it? If he might call me back. If he does, I'm just going to quickly answer it and say, go away, and then come back. Ollie Alexander. It's a tricky one. I thought his character was appalling. Not the acting. I think the acting did the job. I thought in It's a Sin, I thought his character was a very difficult character to like.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, then I think Hayden on Matt pointed out, it was almost... written to be a polarising character, wasn't he?
Yes. Yeah.
The sort of person where, shall we say, a sort of person, maybe, I don't know if those people are still around, would have said, oh, well, they're asking for it, aren't they? You know what I mean?
Which I can't decide whether this was the point or not, because he was the main character, so we're supposed to... I thought the whole point of the programme was we're supposed to... explore the issues surrounding HIV and AIDS in that 80s sphere.
Yeah.
I think it would have benefited from being 8 episodes, and I think it would be a very different story regarding Ollie's character. I can't remember what the character was called.
Ricky, was it?
Richie,
that's it. It ended up being Colin, we were all feeling sorry for.
Perfect, and that's a classic piece of RTD misdirection.
Yes, well, of course, yeah.
As Doctor Who... I think it would revitalise the series in a way that it would put it in the public sphere, but not necessarily, I think, for the reasons... You know, that is going to be your bona fide pop star as Doctor Who, and that's...
Yes.
He obviously has got acting chops, but I'm not sure, and...
It's a bit like going back to that geeky, gawky young man thing again, isn't it?
Yeah.
We've had. So would... regardless of Ollie's... Ollie, what's his name?
Alexander.
Ollie Alexander. Regardless of Ollie Alexander's sexuality, I mean, it's still... Yeah.
Is he actually gay, the actor?
I believe so.
Oh, I didn't realise.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, of course, I must have done, because there was a big thing, wasn't there, with It's a Sin, that he was finally casting an all-gay cast, wasn't it? That's right, yes.
And I have no problem with the fact that Doctor Who has become this gender-fluid character. I think we've seen that in the last few years, prior to Jodie Whittaker, you know, with the regenerations that we've had. But I don't know. I think they're losing direction with where they want to go. And I wonder if I think the rumour's been debunked now, hasn't it?
Yeah.
He's been approached for it.
His agent said he's not interested. It's not true.
It would have been a progressive step for the show, but in some ways a backward step at the same time. And is that the sort of issue we should be discussing when looking at the casting of the lead? I don't know. That always makes it quite an interesting sphere.
Well, he's in vogue, isn't he, as well? I mean, that's the other thing. He's just been in a hit TV show, and is a very... And not only that, but only a few weeks ago now, did a rendition of It's a Sin with Elton John at the Brits. So he's very high profile. So it's a name, basically, that ticks that box, and that it's got people talking. The thing that I would find, again, upsetting, and again goes back to social media, is the fact that some people have made the comment, and I do agree with this to some extent, that could never quite understand why such an inclusive fan base like Doctor Who would all of a sudden be so against the fact that a gay man would be the Doctor. Is just... Yeah, anyway, yeah, don't want to get stuck in that.
I didn't see anyone saying that they were against a gay... Anyone on my social media saying that they were against casting a gay actor. But I did see, I would say half of the tweets relating to Ollie Alexander were about people saying, I can't believe there's still homophobic people out there saying that he shouldn't be in the part.
We've still got people in the Doctor Who community who are saying that Jodie Whittaker should hang herself for what she's done to Doctor Who. You know, we've got Doctor Who fans who can't accept that there's a woman playing the Doctor. And I suppose that's where a little bit of my... When I saw the news, I was a little bit like, nothing to do with his sexuality or anything like that, but I was a little bit like, ooh. Because there's such intense fan ownership, which of course has played the programme now for however many years, but... I mean, it's an interesting point that perhaps there isn't a problem with a gay man playing Doctor Who, but there is a substantial problem with a woman playing Doctor Who. That's shocking, really.
Yes, I think that's probably true. In the same way, that's possibly ironically, I don't think there would be nearly the same amount of backlash in some quarters if the 13th Doctor had been a black actor rather than a female actor. Because I think, I mean, it might seem, you know, counterintuitive, but I suspect they wouldn't be. But I think it's like I often say about social media. We're lucky in that if we go on Diddly Dum's feed, because we're a Doctor Who podcast, Doctor Who fans, well, some of them, the ones with taste, gravitate towards us without us having to ask them. And so we locate them. Oh, I thought I'll follow so-and-so. Or so someone follows us, so we follow them back to be polite. And so we can go on and find a... That's a time stream. What do they call it?
I prefer time streams, to be honest with you.
Yeah, a timeline that's full of Doctor Who fans. Occasionally there'll be someone talking about politics. And if someone's being a nutter, then we'll just either block them or unfollow them. Whereas I think some people might go onto Twitter... And they just type hashtag Doctor Who in to see what's being said about Doctor Who, which means that without any filtering, they get to see what everyone in the world is saying about Doctor Who.
Chris Chibnall should commit euthanasia for what he's done. Jodie Whittaker is an abomination of humanity.
Mm. Right. So no one's heard any rumours about... We've heard loads of rumours about her going, but no one's heard any rumours about who she might be replaced by.
Too early for that. I mean, I'm happy to throw my hat in the ring, but I mean, until they call, I'm just not sure, really.
Right. Right.
Can I throw a question into the mix? That's just.
Yes.
Anybody had a problem with their season 24 box set arriving?
Well, mine arrived today. I thought I'd cancelled it.
Yes, that was the problem. It arrived.
Yeah.
Oh, dear.
Why have you?
Leave the discs. It's the box I want. No, I just wondered because I'd seen there'd been an issue with Amazon. So I pre-ordered 2 hours after it went up, being a Doctor Who fanboy. I was going to say Sylvester McCoy fanboy, but let's face it, it doesn't matter what box set it is. Only to find that they now have suspended the order till the 2nd of August, which is terrific. And I just wanted to raise the rider issue. This is the third in a row I've had a problem getting hold of now. And what the panel's thoughts were about getting hold of this stuff.
Right, so that's so intriguing, because that I started having problems with Amazon with season 14, which is 3 back. So my order was never dispatched for season 14, and then it just all of a sudden arrived one day, which was slightly odd. The season 8 one, the money never left my account. It was stuck in, you ordered this on this date, and I saw someone on Twitter had written, by the way, they've got them in Argos, and I've got an Argos. I literally live like 10 yards from an Argos. So I just went down to Argos and said, hey, can I have season 18 of Doctor Who? And I went, yep. I was like, oh, brilliant. And just handed it over there and then. I got lucky on that occasion. I moved to HMV for them, Matt, because I thought, well, Amazon's let me down twice. So I originally pre-ordered season 24 on there. Then I cancelled that order after the problems I had with Season 8, went to HMV. Then I said to myself, I'm not going to buy any more of the limited editions. I'm actually going to sell them and replace them with the slipcase ones. And like Doc, I actually forgot that this was arriving. Got an email yesterday morning to say, by the way, your order has been dispatched. I was thinking, ah, okay, fair enough. Yeah, that arrived on... Sorry, Monday, yeah. So that arrived on the day it was released. So I think Amazon's just steer clear. Although I did order the slipcase versions of 12 and 19 through Amazon. They came on the same day. So
this is the interesting thing, because I went down, I went thundering down to my local HMV, sort of ambling slightly cross-leggedly as fast as my legs could hobble me. But they don't actually stock it, full stop. Mm. They're not bringing it into the stores. And I was kind of thinking, okay, it's not a major release in terms of some things, but on the other hand, this has got to have a few thousand orders behind it. And it's that and this 1975 special from DWM that seems to be eluding all the shops. It could have dovetails a little into what we just said. The Doctor's not on the front of the annual, so the annual will probably be hard to find. Is the series getting a little bit?
I think it is a case of, yeah, it's all becoming a bit too exclusive. And I actually said to the chaps as well that the limited edition box sets have been creeping up in price. Because when I first ordered season 12, it was $35.99, I think. And now they're $44.99 they're selling them for. So just slipcases, honestly. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going generic.
Yeah, I'm with you. These are all very nice. The extra features are marvellous. The love and care that's gone into them. But yeah. Stop it. If you can't actually buy it on a shelf or you've got to go through all this malarkey, then why bother? We've already got
exactly.
them. We've already bought these things 5 times.
Although I've said to myself, I'm not going to order any more of the limited editions. I'm going to wait for the slipcase to come out. I do suspect if they issue one of Tom's seasons, I might possibly fall back on that, but we'll have to see.
It sounds so entitled here, actually, but... we're so used to the programme being so popular that stuff's on the show.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because if you listen to the Stirrers in Chief, the 42 to Doomsday podcast, when they do one of their merchandising specials, where they'll tend to actually interview someone they know who runs Doctor Who, Star Trek, Star Wars merchandising shop, they'll tell you that the demand is just almost dropped to not exactly to zero. You'll still get the things like the what are those ones that I can never get hold of, like your Santara and Pac Mark.
Oh, the B&M, the B&M ones. Yeah.
But stuff about the current series, they're finding very, so maybe they just we'll order a few. We won't bother ordering a lot because we can't guarantee that people will get them.
No, with the sort of limited edition magazines, it sometimes seems like there's more chance of coming across one in the wild if you're in a supermarket, which is a strange tactic, because I think the Dalek Chronicles special was in supermarkets for a while, but a lot of people couldn't find it in places like W.H. Smith's or John Menzies, so it's very odd sort of distribution technique.
It is.
You may remember, Faithless Sisters, that in our Christmas episode, and this is going to become relevant later on, in our Christmas episode, and we were playing the Feast of Stevens game, one of the questions Hayden asked Mark and me was, how many fellow companions of the First Doctor did Stephen Taylor meet? And it was, I think it was Ian, Barbara, Vicky, Katerina, Sarah Kingdom and Dodo. And I said, oh, why isn't Brett Vian included? And Caden said, oh, well, Sarah Kingdom travelled in the TARDIS, Brett Vian didn't. So how do we class this show?
Gormless.
No,
I'm joking on that one. That was the first word that sprang to mind. She's not gormless by any stretch of the imagination. I'm feeling particularly vinegary today, so this could be an interesting conversation about Mr. Pertwee.
Oh, interesting. Shall we delve in, chaps?
Let's. So let me just... Well, there's one last thing. Oh, two last things. You'll be delighted to hear, faithless listeners, that a couple of weeks ago, I reached my desk, exhausted, flopped down into my desk chair, which you'll know has been creaking to buggery on the in the background of the podcast for a while, and it snapped in half. So I'm now sitting in a brand new desk chair, swinging around, you can't hear a thing. One last thing I think we ought to mention is that it's just come out earlier today that the Capital Five, which thanks to the pandemic has already been put off, I think, about three times, has been announced for Saturday 2nd, Sunday 3rd of April next year at the Crown Plaza at Gatwick.
Oh, that's a bit earlier in the year than usual.
Oh, fantastic.
But yeah, great news.
Special guests to be Bernard Cribbins, Jill Curzon, Jenny Linden, Bonnie Langford, Carol Ann Ford, Peter Purvis, Janet Fielding, so Mark can get a third signature on his special Davison photo, Mark Strickson, Annika Wills, Casey Manning, Lee Binding, not sure who he is, Chris Chapman.
Lee Binding is a graphics designer who does the... Who designs the packaging for the limited edition Blu-rays.
Chris Chapman... David V. Clark. This means that if we're going to be allowed back this year, I think I'm going to have to quickly edit my notes for the forthcoming podcast we're doing. Paul Cornell, Hugh Futcher, Andrew Ireland, Richard Latto, Fernanda Marlowe, Alistair Pearson, friend of Mark, Edward Russell, Robert Sherman, Chris Thompson, Anthony Townsend, and Moreg Westo. Sorry, more guests soon, that says.
I was going to say, I loved her original work.
Faithless listeners, finally, after many months of cajoling votes out of you, we have reached our Third Doctor John Pertwee retrospective podcast.
Hurrah!
Partly delayed by Hayden becoming a father, partly delayed by how long it's taken me to do a complete rewatch. I only finished last week.
Thank God it wasn't Tom Baker's era, right? Otherwise we'd be waiting till Christmas.
I cross the void beyond the mind, the empty space that circles time. I see where others stumble blind, to seek a truth they never find.
Now, let me just open.
Oh, yes. Now, so shall I open this up as well? Because I haven't actually seen this yet.
Right.
I wanted to be surprised. Hang on.
Let's... Well, Mark usually wants to be surprised, so he'll... Okay. That's a nice surprise in it for Mark, so he'd better keep away from it. Matt, I doubt you'll be able to read it anyway.
Horns of Nymon doesn't count, Mark, by the way. That's just the... Right, here we go. Oh my god!
No, it's such a huge spreadsheet, Matt, that you'd probably, if you're doing this on your phone.
Oh my god!
As normal, faithless listeners.
Wow.
Shortly after Christmas, I think it was, we, right about New Year, we, which is the same thing, we sought your votes on your top five favourite Third Doctor stories, which you've very kindly sent in. A few of you sent them in at random, saying these are in no particular order, and I had to browbeat you into putting them into a particular order. As usual, for your first place episode, we gave 5 points, 4 points for your second place, 3 points for your third place, 2 points for your fourth place, and 1 point for your fifth place. And then I totted those up on a largish spreadsheet.
Can I just say, I've opened it up and I'm astonished.
Ooh.
One thing I think is maybe significant about the popularity of the era is that quite a few people said, can we not make it our top 10?
I thought you were going to say, what's significant about the popularity of the era is that they're all John Pertwee stories.
And the main reason why we're not allowing it to be a top 10 is it'll probably take you twice as long to maintain the spreadsheet.
Yeah, I was just thinking, if people say in no particular order, perhaps you should just take their top five and just give them all 3 points each. Because it amounts to the same thing, because there's 15 points spread between five stories. So if they say, well...
Hold on a minute. Hold on a minute. Sophie, are you trying to tell me something? You've put this in a daddy-to-be mug.
Wait.
Hang on a minute.
Wow.
Wow, what a bombshell. There you go. You heard it here first, listeners.
When we did our first retrospective era of Tom's era a few years ago... a grand 26 of you voted. For Bill Hartnell's era, it was 66. For Peter Davison, it was 50. For Sylvester's era, 59 of you voted. For Matt Smith's era, 69 of you voted. And for John Pertwee's era, a grand 131 of you have voted.
For 134, Doc.
134, but three others are us. So we were going to, on the assumption that, which I wasn't sure about until about a couple of hours ago, that all three of us were going to vote anyway.
That's insane, isn't it? That I'm utterly astonished by that. I literally, opening up this grand Dropbox spreadsheet on the Whosium computer has absolutely left me staggered, actually. That's amazing. Thank you so much, everybody.
Well, I look forward to some shocks then later on.
Now, we usually start with a bit of a quiz where Hayden and Mark try to guess which ones...
This is my favourite part of the podcast, usually, where I get to guess which stories have 0 points.
Got nul point. But yeah. Thanks at the last minute to Mr. Charlton's votes, Monster of Peladon ended up with its single vote.
Oh, right.
And given how much we praised Colony in Space... when Matt visited us only a few weeks ago. You might be quite shocked, Matt, to see where that is.
Top, I hope.
So, Smashy, are you there?
I am now, my good dog friend.
What should we do? Should we count down from 24 to 20? Or do you want to go down to 15?
Should we go down in instalments, in a kind of going down in instalments type stuff?
I thought so. Where would you like to end up?
Should we go down to 15?
Okie dokie.
Yeah, let's go down to 15. Okay, cool.
Computer, can you cue the appropriate music, please? Smashy, would you do the countdown from 24 to 15, please?
From 24 to 15, by the Monster of Peladon, where we sat down, it's the Monster of Peladon. At number 23, it's the Doomsday Weapon. No, sorry, I will scrap that. I'm afraid that this story has been the victim of stray votes. It's Colony in Space.
What?
2 points.
Wow. That's really surprising. Having just watched it fairly recently, I thought it was a cracking story. Maybe it's just one of those things that it's just not filtered into people's top five. Maybe it'd be in their top 10 or something, but it's just not.
Who are these people?
Oh, they're the worst type. They're online Doctor Who fans. Fire away, Smashy.
And at number 22, Lupton played guitar, jamming good with Weird and Gilly, and it's the Planet of the Spiders. 13 points. and have joined 20th with 15 points of...
Frontier in Space. Oh, I'm sorry.
No! Frontier in Space, cracking story.
It is, yeah.
And it's tied with the Nativity. Nope, sorry, I will scrap that. It's the Time Monster.
What?
I just heard a microphone smash. Was that a... At number 19, it's the Mutants with 16 points. And at number 18, it's Death to the Daleks on 35 points. At number 17, look at those lovely legs on Mr. Trouson. At 38 points, it's the Curse of Peladon. And a bit of a jump here in a bit of a jump type way. At number 16 on 43 points, it's the Claws of Exos.
Come off it.
That surprised me.
No, I'm down with the Claws of Exos being where it is. That's fine.
Get out.
Now, now, here is an interesting observation, is that you've got...
You're not allowed to say about your own observations.
Well, I'm going to do it anyway. I'm going to try, okay? I'll do my best. Three stories each from season 9 and season 11 are in the bottom 10 stories.
That's a good point, isn't it?
Well, I've not really got much to say about.
Season 9's a really good season. And season 11 is one of my all-time favourite seasons of Doctor Who.
Then why did you only... No, you didn't vote for anything in there, did you? No, yes, you voted for one story. Vote one story.
It's... Yeah, I know, but I...
And it was his top story, though.
Sorry, Mark.
I spread my votes around.
You didn't vote for it, did you?
In fact, look at this. Mark voted for one story in each season.
Yes, he did. How diplomatic.
With my voting, my top two are absolutely nailed on, but...
Yeah.
3 to 5 could have been any of about a dozen different...
Well, that is interesting.
Pertwee stories. It really could be that interchangeable.
Because I've noticed, as I've been sending around a few reminders on Twitter the last few weeks, get your votes in if you haven't already. As well as getting many more new voters in, we've had a few people in who had already voted several months ago and they've forgotten it. And quite a few of them. I was thinking, oh Lord, I hope they've voted exactly the same. Otherwise I'll have to readjust everything. In the end, I said, well, if you voted differently, I'll put what your latest one is. And quite a few of them, the first two, seemed to be roughly the same. They might maybe they'd switch places. But then it was the bottom three that would adjust. And maybe it's a sign of the general quality of the whole era.
I think it's a strong era. I think story-wise, I think we've said in the past, haven't we, on the podcast, because of Letts and Dix being at the helm throughout it, it's the most sort of consistent era that any of the Doctors had. Although, having said that, I suppose Tennant did have RTD the whole time, didn't he? But anyway, I think classic-wise, I think it is the most cohesive anyway.
Simon at Dimwittedly on Twitter was the only one who forgot that he'd voted. But when he did vote again, he gave us an identical 5. Which I was quite impressed by, really. You seem quite surprised at Claws of Access being so low, Matt.
But it's the first blockbuster that you have in Pertwee's era.
Wait till he sees where Mind of Evil is.
Never seen it. That's my rainy day Pertwee. It's the only one I've never seen. Yeah, well, Claws of Axos is kind of the blockbuster. I don't know, maybe I'm quite fond of it, but I'm quite surprised there's a few notable season 8 stories in there, considering it's just, since we're reevaluating these as they come out. I'm guessing most of season 10 is going to be quite highly placed, apart from Frontier in Space. That's a travesty.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you totally. That is, I'm shocked by that, to be
honest. It's quite interesting that there's a lot of the Mac Hulk type stories. So Frontier.
Oh,
the Peladon ones
that's
are quite
interesting. Yes. I mean, Frontier is literally a space opera, isn't it?
Yeah. It's brilliant. I wonder if it's one of those ones that, a bit like Colony in Space for me, maybe watched a long time ago, and then you haven't rewatched it for a long time, and the online, the general opinion of the episode or the story is that it's got these flaws or that flaws. I know Frontier in Space gets like, oh, it's too long, oh, it's too dull, it's just the Doctor and Joe being locked up all the time. And I think if you actually...
I mean, to be fair, it is the Doctor and Joe.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's why I fall asleep during it.
It's lovely.
And I have to admit that both Mutants and Curse of Peladon, I got 5 minutes into it and just abandoned them.
And again, the Mutants is another real world one, isn't it?
It is, yeah, it is.
That's the monster. The Peladonians seem to have as their monarchs the softest people you can imagine, don't they?
Yeah. I think it's one of the... I don't know.
Apparently they only gave the crown to Queen Thamira because she was more masculine than her father.
I think, I've never disliked the Peladon stories, but the one to pick out here for me, and we've done, half the Doctors, I think, in our retrospective so far. I don't think I've ever seen a regeneration story in the Doctor's bottom three.
No.
Time and the Rani?
Oh, sorry. Well, I was thinking more when the Doctor leaves the show, but yeah, no, that's a good point. Time and the Rani, because technically the Sixth Doctor leaves in that. So yeah, fair enough. No.
But in Sylvester's era, weren't all the stories equal bottom?
Only in your mind, Doc. Only in your vote.
Planet of the Spiders is a great end to an era, though. The story's not brilliant, and it's got its problems, but I think as a kind of greatest hits package for Pertwee to say goodbye to him, it's almost perfect, really.
Yeah.
Right, so Smashy, can you give us the countdown from 15 to 10, please?
At number 15, on 47 points, it's Planet of the Daleks. At number 14, it's Matt Jardine's Rainy Day Pertwee story. On 48 points, it's The Mind of Evil.
Oh, cracking tale.
At number 13, unlucky for some, it is indeed for this story. On 67 points, it's Sarah Jane's debut, and it is The Time Warrior. At number 12, on 80 points, it's The Master's debut, and it is Terror of the Autons. And just finishing outside the top 10 in a kind of finishing outside the top 10 kind of way, on 85 points, is The Three Doctors.
That is a surprise that finished only mid-table.
And do you know what? No one should have voted for that, should they, Mark? Because it was financially doped, because there's three Doctors in it.
Not to the extent that Day of the Doctor was, I would say.
Is Three Doctors that you call the Manchester City of Doctor Who?
Oh, no, it's the Day of the Doctor that I call the Manchester City of Doctor Who stories, yeah.
I'm surprised about the Three Doctors. I thought that would have placed a lot higher, actually.
Having said that, there's not one of us that voted for it, so a bit like Mark praising Season 11 and Hayden saying, so why didn't you vote for any of them then?
Well, I did.
Oh, yes, you did. Yeah.
It's quite interesting with that middle bit, that those are all very solid stories. The Mind of Evil, which I've never seen.
Mind of Evil's great. It was very nearly in my top five. See, I still want to say it's one of my favourite Pertwees, even though I didn't vote it in my top five, but it's true.
It's so goddamn gritty, The Mind of Evil, and I think half of that is because the first time I watched it was in its black and white state, and it felt very dark. I mean, I think it is a fairly dark story, but it's quite an ambitious story as well. I quite like it, but again, I'm looking at this list and I'm thinking, barring a couple of stories, there's not really anything I dislike from this era.
No. Regards to Mind of Evil, I think it's a really good Jo Grant story as well.
Mm. She really holds her own, considering she's the only female in that prison. You know, she really does hold her own there. which is interesting because most of the time the prisoners are. But anyway, there you go.
If she was a man, then being in prison would give her no choice but to hold her own.
Exactly. We've all watched Porridge, right? I'm quite heartened to see that the Time Warrior is quite high up because I feel as though fandom again does get quite split over that one. I think it's quite a solid story, but I know Gary Russell hates it, he detests it, and my best man actually hates the Time Warrior as well. I gave him a load of Pertwees to watch when he wanted to do a catch-up on previous Doctor's stories in the build-up to the 50th anniversary, and he said he couldn't stand the Time Warrior and didn't understand why I'd put it in the selection that I'd given to him. So,
So, Smashy, count us down to 7, would you please?
On 100 points at number 10, it's The Sea Devils. At a pipidigit by 1 point, at 9th place, it is The Day, not of the Doctor. No, this one hasn't been financially doped, Mark John. It's Day of the Daleks. And at number 8 on 107 points, which is actually quite close when you look at it, it's Doctor Who and the Silurians. At number 7 on 114 points, is The Ambassadors, wait for it, of Death.
Marvellous. That's definitely my favourite story from Series 7, I would say.
I can't see what people see in Ambassadors.
I'm not a fan.
I think it's, I mean, it's a completely different... Oh, sorry, I'm going to have... Oh, thank you. I'm now on board the Earth capsules known as trains. There he is, Jamie. It is a big one. Ambassadors is, I mean, it's the closest real world thing we've got. You've got the live, the fact that Doctor Who was doing its own version of the sort of moon mission, although albeit to Mars, yes. Must have been so thrilling at the time, because that was new, a bit like the Seeds of Death must have been, all this space travel going on at that time. Plus you've got General Carrington's descent into madness and his nervous breakdown. And you have the wonderful vision of the spacemen, the astronauts. Really irritated. Recovery 7, come in please. Recovery 7. How are we going to make 5? That cliffhanger's terrific. Right,
that is a great cliffhanger. I will give you that. Yeah.
Which one's that?
Yeah, I think it's episode 2 or 3 when they got the capsule and Ronnie Allen's character's asking... He's trying to get in touch with the astronauts inside the capsule. And the
Doctor
tweets,
of course, yeah.
You know, what's the capital of Australia and all that. That's in another director's hands, that would have fallen so flat, but with the cut at the end.
Yeah. My favourite part of the whole of Ambassadors of Death is the fact that they had enough in the budget to get Peter Gabriel to play Ralph Cornish.
seriously, though, it does have a really good cast.
It does, yes it does.
And the henchman is, what's his name? The one who does all the legwork and like the kidnapping and the stuff with the van.
Collinson.
He's fantastic as well.
Yeah.
It's the closest you come to thinking that the companion's actually going to cop it. Because there's some quite nasty stuff in there.
Oh, even the fight sequence in the warehouse in the first part is incredibly gritty too. I mean, that's... My biggest takeaway point was just how dynamic the story is. But I think it's one of those where I wasn't captured by its brilliance as a child, which means that I haven't had the nostalgia of it set in. I only saw it, first time I saw it was actually at Riverside Studios when they showed one of the colourised episodes, probably about 2012, I reckon now. And then the DVD came out, so it's... It was always that last one in season 7 for me to watch. It was
funny because you've probably watched it before I did, because I've only it about 4 or 5 years ago. Yeah.
Oh crikey! Okay. Oh, it's just me then, I reckon. Tell you what, I'm excited by this top 5, which is actually a top 6, but ooh. I'm excited by it.
Now, Mark.
Yes.
Hayden has counted down from 24 to 7, and we've still not heard the notorious, much maligned word, dinosaurs, have we?
Mm.
And for a long time, it was hovering on 5. Then, suddenly a swathe of votes would come in from Carnival of Monsters fans.
Bah! Carnival of Monsters is great.
And by yesterday, it was languishing in 8th place until yours and Polly's votes came through. Hayden, yay! Would you like to give us the countdown from 5 to 1, please?
I certainly will, my doc friend.
number 5, and it's drawn, it's a tie, yes, a tie, on 120 points between Carnival of Monsters and, wait for it, Mark, Invasion of the Dinosaurs.
Yeah!
Woohoo! And at number 4, and 130 points, it is The End of the Road for the Doctor's friend Joe in The Green Death.
Oh, do you know what? I thought that might be slightly higher. There we are.
I've got a massive jump in points here, top 3 now. At number 3 on 182 points is Spearhead from Space. And in the runner-up spot on 213 points is The Daemons. Which leaves at number 1 with an astonishing 318 points is Inferno.
Hooray!
Wow.
And they were all wearing eye patches.
So can we guess that the one you were sighing at in being the top 5, Matt, was Invasion of the Dinosaurs?
No, Invasion of the Dinosaurs I really liked a few years ago. That was the last one out on VHS, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. It was, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and I really enjoyed it when I watched it. And then I went back and watched the DVD and just thought, this is actually... And I'm a big Mac Hulk fan, but it's a Mac Hulk too far for me.
Really?
I mean, we reviewed it a few years ago, and I watched it again last year with a friend of mine who hadn't seen it before, and I really enjoyed it, and I do think it is that old classic thing with Doctor Who where a special effect lets it down. But if you do look past the special effects, which we can do, but others can't, unfortunately, there's a really rich story in there.
Mm.
And it was one of those, it was hovering in my top 5 around it. I didn't go for it in the end, but it was probably, if I was to take this whole list, it would probably, well, definitely be in my top 10. I'd say that.
I've got 4 words. I sold my house! I think it's a beautifully woven plot. I think every one of the main characters, including the unit secondary characters, are given something to do. I think everyone shines in it. And I absolutely adore the story. There's bits of it I'm not sure are hugely logical. But no, I just love it. I mean, Elizabeth Sladen's brilliant in it as well. Just it's one of my all-time favourites.
I think it's a belting story whose reputation is determined entirely by those bloody dinosaur models.
Yeah.
And people talk about Barry Letts's environmentalism and everything. This is by far the most political of all Pertwee's stories. All the stuff about the reminder room and you mustn't think like that is... He's clearly in the same, as I've said this before, in the same way, which has never stopped me because I'm repeating myself, in the same way that Sunmakers is Robert Holmes's chance to have a bit of a dig at the Inland Revenue, Dinosaurs is clearly to me Mac Hulk's opportunity to have a bit of a dig at the loonies in the Communist Party of Great Britain, who were constantly trying to throw him out of their party for not being pure enough.
Also, the main environmentalist in the story, who the Doctor's like on extremely good terms with very early on and admiring of, turns out to be the baddie, which I think is actually quite a neat subversion of expectations.
The one senior civil servant in the whole Pertwee era bestrewn with them that you actually like.
Mm.
That is true. That is true.
What were you going to say about it, Matt?
I was just going to say it's interesting. Oh, here we go. Here comes... Space 7 again. Might wait for that to finish, so you can start to background them.
Where are you, Matt, at the moment?
I was going to say I'm on a Virgin Pendolino. I'm not. I'm on an Avanti West Coast service, just going past the McVitie's factory in Levenshulme at something like 120 miles an hour. What I was going to say was that it's interesting that this Mac Hulk story peaks at the top, and really, it's interesting to say it's the most political story. It perhaps is. But not in a way that Colony in Space is about agriculture and colonisation. It's not Mac Hulk. It's about colonialism. This is actually quite a straightforward science fiction story at heart.
Yeah.
With the environmental trappings and leanings. But the reminder room is quite George Orwell. So I think it's
Yeah, that's what I mean by political. Yeah. It's not the environmentalism of it.
So it's interesting to see that's peaked so high. And I was going to argue that perhaps stories like Spearhead from Space and Inferno that have been commercially available for quite a long time, that might be why they're peaking so high in this, but this blows that theory out of the water.
Well, we know why Dinosaurs has peaked so high. It's the cultural influence of the Diddly Dum podcast. Ever since Mark turned up with us, he has been pushing the invasion of the dinosaurs. He converted me. I put it fourth in mine. Wow. Mark put it first in his. Mark's daughter Polly, who's clearly... Mark clearly keeps her in a reminder room. I gave it 4 points. Polly gave it 4 points. Mark gave it 5. Hayden didn't even bother Mark.
Like I said, it would be in my top 10, but there are 5 stories which are much dearer to my heart than that, so...
Why can't we have a top 10?
The question, dear, was top 5. Not top 5, not top 9, not top 10, not top 11, but top 5.
Polly did choose hers independently, but you'll notice that there's only one difference in our top 5s with me and Polly. The rankings are slightly different anyway, but there's only one story each that's different. And basically the 4 that we've gone for that tally with each other, those are ones that we've sat down to watch together repeatedly. And I think that's obviously why we both have the same. Because watching them together with Polly, it definitely brought the John Pertwee era to life for me and made it... I derived so much more pleasure from watching it because there are stories that I can sit down and watch with my oldest daughter. I get more from that than I do just watching like an old favourite Tom Baker by myself. And I think it's that watching it and appreciating it with somebody else is a much more powerful thing. And it's that confirmation thing, isn't it? You know, if you're agreeing that you both love this story, you're both compounding each other's love for it, I guess.
Is that how it is for you, Doc, as well? Your love of it with Mark? You want to be a part of his gang with him and Polly?
Dinosaurs?
Yeah.
And possibly a little sympathy, that considering how badly it's been maligned. But they're pretty dreadful, the models of the dinosaurs.
Yeah.
But no, I love Grover. I think it's a pity that Peter Miles gets... although the role of his character is very significant, he doesn't get much of a look in, does he?
No, he doesn't.
Thank you. That's what I wanted to know.
It is one of the final hurrahs of the UNIT family, isn't it?
It's the icing in the middle of the cake of the Mike Yates trilogy as well, isn't it?
Yeah, indeed. Yes.
So.
I do love me a bit of the Mike Yates trilogy, yes. proper character arc and everything.
I have to say, I've done it again, chaps, and I do apologise. Actually, no, I don't apologise, but 4 of my 5 picks are in the top 5.
Hey, hang on, you jammy bugger.
They are. The only one that hasn't reached it was the Sea Devils, which was in at 10, and that was my 5th place choice.
See, I don't think I've bothered tossing them up this time. Let's see.
But I have to say, like with our joint 5th, Carnival of Monsters is such a good... that's obviously Robert Holmes, isn't it? For a 4-parter and just one... If I think to myself, I want to sit down, I've got about an hour and a half, I want to watch a Pertwee, it's between 2 stories for me. And it's either Spearhead from Space or it's Carnival of Monsters. Carnival of Monsters, I think, is such a great idea. You know, this collection, this almost like this zoo, this peep show, which was ironically originally going to be its name. I'm quite pleased I didn't call it that, to be honest with you. But anyway, I just love it. It's so... the imagination behind the idea and the Drashigs as well, which always, like, as a kid, whenever you saw a picture of a monster, you thought, that's so cool. That looks like nothing else I've seen before. These weird, like, huge heads bursting out of the ground. And
they're great when they're in the swamps.
The best bit.
They're magnificent. And also, you get some pretty good dinosaur action in Carnival of Monsters too. So,
ironically, better than you do in Invasion of the Dinosaurs, yeah.
Yeah, well, yeah.
And, of course, we have Ian Malta turning up a couple of seasons early, which was always a bit of a shock when he's playing the captain of the ship, isn't he?
Mm.
Shiruna. I love that one. But the one for me, the jewel in the crown of this top four, and I voted it second, is The Green Death. And I think it's... I've written in my book, I think that this is the story that made me a Doctor Who fan. It's fantastic. I watched it again when the Season 10 box set came out, and it's just so brilliantly written, and it's such a fantastic end to Katie Manning's time on the show. The fact that Cliff is written to be this younger version of the Doctor, this younger human version of the Doctor, a form of a Doctor that Jo could fall in love with and settle down with, that she never could.
I only noticed that on this rewatch. You know how she does the... In Terror, she wrecks the Doctor's experiment. Yeah. In Green Death, she comes in and wrecks... It hadn't occurred to me that happened. I was quite impressed by that.
Mm. Well, it's the fact as well that, you know, you have the monsters in this. You have the giant maggots, and of course they're well remembered, aren't they, by public on... When it comes to the pantheon of the monsters, the giant maggots, oh, it's the one with the maggots. But it's the fact that even the baddie in this, even Stevens, is... You feel sorry for him at moments during this. Like when he's opposed to the death of... God, I've forgotten his name now. Fell, isn't it? No, not Fell. What's the name? They fry his brain and he jumps off the side of the building.
Oh, yes.
And he's saying, it's not necessary. And then he sort of sits at his desk and puts his head in his hands. And you just think, it's still... Yeah. It's no wonder that at the end, he blows Global Chemicals up and stays behind.
He's called Fell.
Is it Fell? I thought it was Fell. Right, okay. It's the tension of when they're down in the mine as well. And how impressive the glowing green looks at the start of the... where John Scott Martin's miner pulls on the alarm. And it's just there. You just see the hand glowing. I remember being really impressed by that when I was 7 years old watching the box set for the first time. And just how incredibly sad the ending is too. You know, and it's one of those where... I know a lot of classic fans have said this about the new series recently, but you know how the music sort of is telling the viewer how to feel, especially during Murray Gold's era on the show.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's no music here at all. It's all done through silences and looks, and it's that feeling of sadness as he gets in Bessie and him drives away, and it's just such a good ending. It's such a brilliant story. I honestly think it's almost... It's a 10 out of 10 for me every time I watch it. And I honestly do believe it's one of the best Doctor Who stories ever written.
That final scene is superb. And I'm talking about him driving away and Bessie there, that final shot with the sunset.
Mm.
Just beautiful. And also, I think the episode one is absolutely magnificent.
It
sets everything up so beautifully. That the parting of the Doctor and Joe early on, where they... He can't believe that she wants to do something else that isn't going with him in the TARDIS. So he goes off, right, well, I'm going to go to Metabilis 3 then. And the scenes on Metabilis 3, I just adore them. When he's just running about being pursued. Like when you see those big bird legs coming flying past and those spears hitting the TARDIS, it's just absolutely joyous. It's very sort of comedic and the way he turns up back at the office and the phone's ringing. And he lurches out of the TARDIS, grabs the phone and says, yes, I'll speak to anyone. And he's all dishevelled. And
there's an awful lot of humour in this story.
Yeah.
That I hadn't thought of before. And even it's all throughout the story. You've got these little moments which are actually quite lighthearted. And I really like them.
Mm, the Doctor's disguises.
Yeah. It's that, they're all over the place. After
It's interesting that I think this one is the most consistently popular among the four of us. Bob, Mark and Hayden put it in second place, and Matt and I put it in fourth place for ourselves. I wonder if, though, this is the Green Death votes have been financially doped, because I didn't ask for anyone's nationality when they sent the votes in. But I wonder if there's been a surge of Welsh fans.
Welsh pride.
Because, as we all know, the Welsh have been massively underrepresented in Doctor Who while being massively overrepresented in Doctor Who podcasting.
Now, Doc, I want you to concentrate. Right, take a look at this blue sapphire. Look deep into the crystal, Doc.
That's funny as well. Metabilis 3, they keep talking about there's a famous blue planet. You can plan to the Spanish, you get there. Nothing's blue.
Yeah, I know. It's just, and you don't get any big bird legs. Maybe that's why Planet of the Spiders is in 22nd place. Big bird legs are missing. What do you think, Matt?
Your Green Death's very nostalgic because it came in that after that Planet of the Daleks and the repeat season. That's where I first saw it. So watching it unfold one episode at a time with no knowledge of what could be next was very satisfying. You know, like you say, it's great. It's the fantastic cliffhangers. Even the reveal of, I'm the computer.
Oh, yes. Mm. I am the boss. I'm all around you. Yeah.
Stevens.
played by the guy who plays Lupton in Spiders.
John Darth. I think the Green Death is arguably the most people you speak to, if they watch Doctor Who at that time and aren't dyed-in-the-wool fans, they'll name the one with the maggots, and I found the one with the gargoyle.
Yeah.
So it's no surprise to me. And then, swiftly following up from that, the one with the shop dummies.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, that's true.
Carnival of Monsters is the one I just bores me to death.
Yeah, oh, I'm glad you said that, because it does to me too.
Oh.
Oh, dear. Oh.
It bores me rigid. It's a bit like me in City of Death. It's supposed to be a stone-cold classic. They bore me senseless. Give me all 10 episodes of The Peladon back-to-back with matchsticks to keep my eyes open till they bleed over 4 episodes of that. Can't put my finger on it. I couldn't tell you. It looks great. It is imaginative. You know, the Doctor and Joe running around miniaturised inside that machine. But just something about it, just...
And Vorg trying to be Kenneth Williams.
Do you think that the problem may be that it's kind of, look at these boring bureaucrats, and therefore it's actually like, yeah, but I don't really want to watch boring bureaucrats.
Yeah.
I find the scenes on the ship very boring.
Oh, yes, yeah.
I mean, of course, when Cutaway Comics comes around to doing the Vorg adventures, Carnival Monsters are suddenly my favourite story. But I just, it bores me absolutely rigid. And I can't explain why. What else we have? We've got the demons. I don't really understand why Spearhead from Space is up there either.
No, me neither. Not in the top 5.
I should say I'm not a big Robert Holmes fan. Well, I think he's
top place for me.
Oh, I'm going to be really controversial here. I think Robert Holmes is quite a lazy writer.
Hang on, let's say that more dramatic. Say that once more, man.
I think that Robert Holmes is actually quite a lazy writer. There we are. Said it.
In what sense? Considering how talented he is, or...
No, I think... I read the book, the Richard Molesworth... I think it's Richard Molesworth. The Telos book, the biography of it. And actually, you see, he reuses the same ideas and the same concepts time after time after time after time. Possibly because he wrote so much, it's quite obvious when you watch the contemporary things like his Bergerac, I'm going to put that one in there, his Avengers, his other bits and pieces. You just look at them and go, oh, well, that's Vorg and Schoener, but just in a contemporary modern day. Or that's the two doctors, the culinary couple, Oscar and Carmen, or whatever she's called. I think that, you know, Spearhead from Space is, I think it's a fairly relatively poor script. Bearing in mind, by this point, he's done the Crotons and the Space Pirates, which are not exactly the top lead regard. But because it's done on location and on film and directed quite well by Derek Martinus, I think you end up with a good story.
Yeah, I think definitely the overall look of the story gives it a much higher reputation.
Yeah, the look determined it for me. And I would have loved to have been around to have watched the Shop Windows Dummies moment on first broadcast. You know, and not having been told for years, oh, this is a brilliant point. But suddenly you think, oh my God.
But you don't see anything. They don't smash the window.
No, because it would be too expensive. I think that's just as dramatic.
So what else have we got in there? We've got the demons in there as well, haven't we?
Yes, in second place.
I enjoy the demons. I do like the demons. But it's not a top pick for me. I did put it in my top 5. I think I put it third. It's one that actually gets better every time I see it. First time I saw it, I didn't see what the whole sort of love for it was, because I mean, the Brigadier doesn't really turn up until episode 4, and the Doctor's incapacitated in the second one, I just thought the rest of it's just kind of Benton and Yates in turtlenecks running around the village up to that point.
What more do you want?
But actually, but no, every time I see it, I see something else I like in it. I think it's arguably Roger Delgado's best performance. Yeah, I think it's a good adventure. I like it. I think six parts, it wouldn't have worked. I think five is just about does it for me at five. But yeah, really enjoyable. Really enjoyable story. But my biggest gripe with it is just what an asshole Pertwee, isn't it?
Right, good. Glad somebody's mentioned that. It's not just indicative of that story.
Oh, no, not at all.
No.
Poof! Here comes the box opening now. Terror the Autumn's an absolute cock in.
Yeah.
It's a what?
He's an absolute cock in it.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
He's awful to... I mean, no wonder Liz buggered off.
Yeah, he's not very nice, is he? It's interesting because there's another Doctor that I really cannot stand who's very popular with fans, who is a bit of an arrogant prick most of the time as well.
I know. Peter Cushing.
Peter Cushing. What a tosser.
Hang on. But Hayden, you can't leave us dangling like that. Who are you talking about?
What, who's the other Doctor that I can't stand? David Tennant. Awful.
Oh, David Tennant.
Yeah, cannot stand him. But what does it with Pertwee's Doctor is he does mellow as time goes on. And he is less of that. I think by about halfway through season 9, you don't see it as much. And by season 10, which I think is his best season, personally, I think that's pretty much gone, really. The fact that Joe is standing up against him in the Green Death the character's completely changed by that point. But I think season 8 is the height of his knobbishness, really, where he is... I mean, isn't there a bit in The Demons when he's having a go at the Brigadier and then Joe's sort of like, oh yeah, yeah, that Brigadier, hey? And then he just completely rounds on Joe and has a go at her. Yeah, oh, yeah. It's just, what a sod.
Yeah, so when the Brigadier says, I'm calling the Air Force to try and bomb through the heat barrier.
Yeah, that's it.
Doctor turns off his walkie-talkie. She says, military idiot or something. He says, you might show him a bit more respect. He's doing the best he can. Yes.
I hate that.
And there's the real life spillover, isn't there? Because he shouts at her over the map in the car. But that's because he shouted at her in real life as well, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Really?
Yeah, he did, yeah.
I always thought they'd got on.
They did, yeah. But I think he was getting a bit fed up with her short eyesightedness.
Oh, really?
Oh, dear.
Might want a spider on that bit.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, come on. Don't worry. I will spidey this, but I want to know. Friendly neighborhood Spider-Man. Wealth and fame, he's ignored. Action is his reward to him. Life is a great big pain. Wherever there's a hang, you'll find a Spider-Man. I know. What's annoying is that he... You know, his reputation as being a very establishment doctor, I think that rests on a lot of nonsense, but there's enough there of him being an arrogant prick to sustain that sort of argument on its own, isn't it? It's all of establishments. Paul Cornell's review of Terror of the Autons, as originally printed in DWB 112 in 1993, well, he goes on about him being, effectively, they make the Doctor a Tory.
Well, isn't there this... I mean, there's the reference to that old Tubby Rowlands, you better check your stuff with him. But isn't there a Paul Cornell short story where he may have dreamt this, where he goes and plays cards in, like, the Conservative Club or something?
But I think that's what it's based on. It seems obvious to me. He's swatting away his annoying civil servant by pretending that he's on first-name terms
with his boss. I don't think it's true at all. If you think about it, I kept a diary in my late teens. And it's always a bad idea, because looking back, it shows what a pretentious prick I used to be. Pausing there to allow you two to say, used to be. Well, at least only I get to read it. I don't know if Cornell was trying to make a name for himself. But it does show up the literalness of the mindset of some fans. I've swallowed it whole and repeat it to this day as the reason why the Third Doctor is an establishment type. Surely, it's obvious he's making it all up as a ruse. All he needs to know is the name of the minister or civil servant at the top of that department that unit deals with. And he could just pull it off. It's a bit like me meeting, say, I don't know, an over-officious passport official. And I said to them, I was saying to the Pritzker only the other day at that BNP rally, wrong sort of chat getting into your department these days, pretty. I suppose in one way you have to admire Cornell's nerve in trying to patronise Bob Holmes, even though Matt just seems to think so. He says, Bob Holmes, not that that makes him a bad writer. He's 25 when he's writing this. How arrogant do you have to be? How bumptious do you have to be?
Said he was a lazy writer.
Oh, that's all right then. I mean, if he said that today after his own successful writing career, you'd think that's a bit bumptious, but at 25. He says that doesn't make him a bad writer. Indeed, his honesty and character mark him out from some of the later fakes. I mean, this is... At least Chibnall was 7 years younger when he was doing this. And this idea that when he says, nonsense, gentlemen talk about nothing but money, he's taking that literally as well. And therefore, he knows lots of upper-class gentlemen. But it's just, I could come out with that sort of snarky line if someone queued me up for it. And then there's a strange thing where he says, he talks about a selfish and bitter piece that Robert Holmes wrote about himself for the Peter Haining book. And we've been through all the Peter Haining books we know.
Oh, I can't find it.
We can't find it anywhere. But from a slightly witty thing that he wrote for the Doctor Who file. Are you familiar with that, Matt?
I've just got my copy. I've got home. I'm not time-travelling through capsules anymore. I've just plucked my copy of the Doctor Who file off the shelf.
No, that's not the one. Well, I mean, if that's the only one, all he's doing is joking about, what a slow writer he is. He just makes some joke about two actors meeting each other on the set of Doctor Who after an unhappy divorce between them. And I just think, oh, is that what it's meant to be? But sounds bizarre to me anyway. But at least, when do you think he starts becoming less of a prick?
The problem why we can view him as this Tory arsehole, because he... You can't see Tom Baker doing that. You can't see any of the other doctors doing that, really. Not even Capaldi. So I'm not convinced he ever does, because he's quite offish to Sarah Jane to begin with.
Yeah. I mean, that's interesting, isn't it? That just makes him an arsehole, doesn't it? Just makes him mean that he's an upper-class arsehole. And I suppose it doesn't help in Day of the Daleks when he's saying... he's eating Gorgonzola and wine and saying, a trifle cynical, if not sardonic. Right, Inferno came top, way out in top with 318 points.
Fantastic. It's the third best Doctor Who story ever made, in my opinion. It's brilliant. It's taken the Doctor completely out of his comfort zone. He's already stuck on Earth, and now he's stuck on an even worse version of Earth. The tension all throughout is palpable. The acting's brilliant. The writing's excellent. The Primords I like, even though they... can look a little silly. I find the premise of it is something that 50 years on, Doctor Who's hinted at doing again, especially in series 12 just gone, but never quite got over it. I think the way that you have the switch of the parallel world just adds another dimension to the story. There we go, people. I love how sardonic the brigade leader is as well, actually. He's so...
Yes, yeah.
It's dripping with brilliance.
And it's big stakes as well, isn't it? Because it's
huge.
Not only is the world about to end, but we've seen it end.
Yeah.
Or do we know it's ending just in the next room, as it were?
It's the bit of survivor's guilt that he has when he comes back in episode 7 that, terrible things are happening there, Liz. Terrible things. You know, it's just so good. That build up, episode 6 cliffhanger. Oh, no, I just love it. 10 out of 10.
Brilliant. It does give the makers of Doctor Who to have their cake and eat it, doesn't it? Yeah. Because they get to show him fail, well, on a global level, and yet still manage to be the saviour as well.
Yeah.
Thoughts on Inferno, Matt?
Stone cold classic. Start to finish. Absolute stone cold classic. I think it's the right length. It's not an episode too long. I think the behind the scenes tension only made the final product an amazing show. This is the one that Pertwee can get away with being abominable, but even he's out of his depth a bit.
After my first two absolute locked in choices, it'll be amongst that pack of like about a dozen stories that I could have picked from.
So I think we ought to let you all know then, Hayden's top five in order were Inferno, Green Death, Demons, Carnival, and Sea Devils. Mine were Spearhead, Dinosaurs, Terror, Green Death, and Day of the Daleks. Matt's were Inferno, Ambassadors, Claws, Green Death, and Monster Peladon. And Mark's were Dinosaurs, Green Death, Demons, Ambassadors, and Time Monster. What do we think of the companions, Liz, Joe, and Sarah? Matt, were you joking earlier on what you said about Liz Shore? Or
yes, I was. No, Liz was a very good companion, actually, because she fits that era perfectly. Unfortunately, they did create a character that was too clever for its own good, because you need someone to tell the audience what's going on.
Yes,
a bit. They were quite clever, especially in Inferno, having the alternate Liz, because otherwise it could have gone down quite a path where actually we have got no idea what's going on. Silurians is probably the closest it gets to that. I think she was, you know, obviously behind the scenes, she elected to leave because she was pregnant and Barry Letts didn't know because he'd gone to give her the chop. You know, I think it's a shame we didn't get another season out of her. I think some of the spin-off materials played with it wonderfully. The various ways that Liz leaves in the books and drifts off and drifts back into the Doctor's life is quite interesting. She's easily forgotten when put up against Katie Manning, then, as Joan.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, my favourite season is probably Series 11, Season 11, but it's, even despite that, you still have to say that Jo is the main third, well, obviously because of the amount of seasons she did, but it's Jo Grant that remains the iconic Third Doctor companion.
She's very easy to love, especially when you've been hugged by her four times, isn't she, Mark?
yes, she is. Yes, always fantastic value. Convention's very generous with her time as well.
Mm, yeah.
Lovely person, Katie Manning.
Well, looking at the seasons, Series 7 garnered 36% of the total vote. Series 8 and Series 10 had 19% each. The Series 10 is just ahead by a few percentage points.
Mm.
Series 9, that's Day of the Daleks, Sea Devils, etc., had 13%. And Series 11 was down at the bottom with only just under 12%. Didn't seem to be very popular.
Yeah, when I was younger, Season 11 was regularly touted as one of the worst seasons of Doctor Who.
Do we feel that maybe there's too much of an idea that, you know, it is sort of John's on his way out?
Well, it is transitioning, isn't it, into the Baker era? Because even to the point that you've got the new companion there, you've got the new title sequence, you've got UNIT being faded out even more so than they have been the season before.
Yeah,
I think it is. I think it's that dip. But then I think if Season 11 hadn't have been on that path, then we wouldn't have got such a strong Season 12, to be honest with you.
Possibly.
There we go.
It's a pity, in fact, because Liz drives, even though she's nowhere near as clever as, I'm thinking Liz, one with a Z on an S. Sarah, although she's nowhere near as clever as Liz, drives the plot far more than either Joe or Liz do, doesn't she? She's driving a lot of the plot in the time warrior. She's on her own a lot of the time warrior, isn't she?
Yeah.
She's doing stuff on her own in Dinosaur. She goes off. She's the one who reveals that Grover's the baddie in Dinosaur. She's on a lot of her own in that fake spaceship. And it's a pity, I think, that not all the stories are as possibly of the quality that would go with that. UNIT.
I think it's sad that what happens to the Brigadier, because if you think about it, when he's, I think it mainly changes when he changes uniform. When he's in that rather, should we say, very 60s uniform, he's not at all fazed by the Doctor's being a prick, is he? And towards the end, certainly in something like Green Death, where he really doesn't take any shit from Stephen to the people at Global Chemicals, it's a pity that, that in between, I think his lowest point is the Three Doctors, where he's some buffoon just talking about Cromer and saying, oh, we've got to do an inventory of the building. It's going to be an international incident. But I don't know why they do it.
The Three Doctors is an interesting one because you have Sergeant Benton, who takes everything in his stride. I mean, he sees the inside of the TARDIS for the first time. He doesn't really blink an eye at it. And yet the Brigadier is turned into a complete and utter buffoon for the first time and the last time. It's a very strange tone to have gone down. You know, the very next story that he appears in would be Green Death, wouldn't it? In which he's far from a buffoon.
I think that's, regards to Benton's response, I think that's kind of in keeping with the character. I think he's, you know, when they're trying to explain Tom Tit in the Time Monster, and the Doctor's trying to explain interstitial time, and Benton says, oh, so you mean the time between now and now? Which doesn't really work, but it shows that he's kind of understanding it. I think the thing with Benton is he's kind of, he's probably not the brightest of the unit soldiers, so he's not so easily freaked out, I think, by things. Mm.
Something I noticed, but I hadn't noticed before. You know how there's always the big fuss about how in Zygons, the Brigadier says, yes, madam, on the phone to the Prime Minister. And it's meant to be a prediction that Margaret Thatcher will become first woman Prime Minister. I hadn't noticed that when he's in Green Death, and you know Stevens puts him on the phone to the, I can't remember who played him, but the very large-whiskered minister who's at Cabinet, mm-hmm. to say, Brigadier, do as you're told by Global Chemicals. And the minister can't persuade the Brigadier. So he hands the phone over to the Prime Minister to give the Brigadier a telling off and says, Jeremy.
Oh, yes, yeah.
You have a word with him. And, of course, at that time, Jeremy Thorpe was still the leader of the Liberal Party. And I wonder if that's meant to be a joke about perhaps one day Jeremy Thorpe, well, that's quite popular. Oh, clearly not. Maybe that's far too before your times.
Quite interesting to see how much of Nick Courtney's politics did creep into a couple of those things.
Oh, really?
I don't know if they do, but the female Prime Minister is supposed to be an ad-lib. No doubt that's an ad-lib as well.
No, it's the bearded Cabinet Minister who says Jeremy.
Oh, is it?
Because the Prime Minister, the Brigadier would be calling the Prime Minister Sir, wouldn't he? So, but as for the era as a whole, I don't think you can divorce it from the fact that Barry Letts and Terence Dix were in charge throughout. Which possibly makes it the second most consistent era in all of Doctor Who, behind Paul McGann's. There was no swinging from Hinchcliffe to Williams to J&T. Or at least that consistency covers certainly the middle three seasons, which all got, well, 8 and 10 got almost exactly the same marks. Maybe season 7 does stand out qualitatively. I don't think the era is consistently amazing, but it's got a consistently good standard. And it really, as far as I'm concerned, it's only got 4 turkeys out of the whole 24.
Season 7 for me, I think, is quite a dry season. It's a very serious programme,
it feels
during Season 7.
That's why I can't be doing with Ambassadors. It's just far too serious and dry. I thought it was interesting that I was looking at, John is the second longest serving Doctor. But it's interesting how we look at it. We always think, don't we, Tom, 7 years. But actually, he only serves for 6. Unless, if we're talking about from his first episode of Robot to the last episode of Logopolis, he's only around for 6 years, 3 months. I suppose if he's, you know, if you do it from when he regenerates, you know, when he's around in the country as the actor who plays him, it's longer. John is, 4 years, 6 months. But what I found interesting was, if you look at the number of episodes that they did, in other words, how many weeks were you watching Doctor Who? Tom is obviously out at, hugely out on his own. He's 172, or 173 if you include Sharda. And John's got 128. But Bill Hartnell's got 134. So he's almost a year and a half less time in the role than John. But because in those days, they only stopped broadcasting .2 for about 2 weeks of the whole year, didn't they? In Hartnell's day.
Yeah.
And so you could argue that he's the second longest serving Doctor.
Well, he did have a few weeks off, though, didn't he?
Yeah, that's true. Perhaps like when I say, oh, Hayden, that you don't count as recording the podcast that week. You only censored an insert. That's going to be a bit like the Celestial Toy Maker.
Yes.
Turns out he just sends his hand in. Where are we, by the way, on that? This is my 143rd. It's Hayden's 104th. It's your 88th mark. But 88th consecutive mark.
Right, yeah.
And Matt, it's your 26th at the moment. So, Matt, if you only need to do two more podcasts with us and you'll have overtaken Al Noh and the Rev.
Right, well, that's a challenge. That's a challenge. One thing I want to mention, actually, before we do this up is, I suppose, one of the unsung heroes of the era is Barry Letts.
Yeah, I think, I don't know if it's just me, but I love it. Have you read his biography?
Yes.
Yeah. Or his half biography. Yeah, I love him.
You know, he changes the way the programme's made, and that longevity perhaps ensures that the programme is economically better to make and also takes the pressure off a little bit in terms of delivering it, doing the two a fortnight instead. And the introduction of CSO also gives a boost in the arm as to what is achievable at the same time. I think he's... obviously, Terence gets a lot of love and affection, but behind the scenes, Barry Letts is pulling a lot of strings that affect how Doctor Who's made right throughout the 70s, and arguably is the architect of it being made in the 80s by overseeing JNT's first season.
Yeah.
I was going to say that. It's not surprising that he's the first person they go to, is it, in the 80s to come and be a helping hand? Although I don't think he was... needed that much.
And I do like the sense that it's quite clear that they really were great pals. I hate it when two people in Doctor Who clearly have got problems with it. That's why I never listen to any of the commentaries in Lala's era. And I don't listen to many of the ones in Matthew and Janet's era either. Because it is clearly... they're almost ignoring Matthew in most of those. I don't think Lala even agrees to appear on the same. Don't she and Tom record Big Finish stories in different studios?
Well, I've heard that is the case, and I've heard it is also the case that Tom's got his own studio attached to his house. He doesn't be with anybody anymore, as such, and especially I think post pandemic, I can foresee that he won't go into a studio because why bother if you've got one?
No, it's understandable, isn't it? Yeah.
I think there's always the story that the two of them won't see each other, but he's got his, even if he didn't use that studio, he has a studio near Kent where he lives that he uses, that he wouldn't necessarily, they kind of split them up half and half. But somebody did tell me they had recorded one together, but I don't know how true that is or not. I mean, there's pictures of Lala Ward and Matthew Waterhouse together at a recording with Big Finish. I think she can't stand him, even with a distance of time, which I think is a bit much. I mean, Janet ribs Matthew Waterhouse. I think there's quite an interesting panel with them both on one of the Blu-ray box sets from sort of the mid-90s, where it's just gentle humour. Janet perhaps maybe goes too far on the case, but Lala Ward absolutely loathes Matthew Waterhouse, and I can't, even with a distance of time, is it just let it go? Weird. It's strange, and it's that prickliness does come across on screen in that era.
Yes, it does, doesn't it? But then I think you read the Blue Box Boy, and he gets to work on Doctor Who, and he turns up at the Acton Hilton, and what an appalling atmosphere he walks into. She used to lecture him, didn't she, on being so immature. He walks into a set where his two role models of how an adult actor is supposed to behave would act out rehearsed scenes without looking each other in the eye, and then flounce off to opposite corners of the room and glare at each other until the next scene. You think, she's got the nerve to lecture an 18-year-old for being immature.
And also, you got Tom Baker, who's telling him to piss off. Isn't that the quote?
Yes, exactly. That was... I mean, unless he was being a bit, you know, clingy, and that was just the and this one bit won't go out, but
Spider-Man does whatever a spider can, spins a web any size, catches thieves just like flies. Look out, here comes the Spider-Man. Is he strong? Listen, bud. He's got radioactive blood. Can he swing from a thread? Take a look overhead. Hey there goes the Spider-Man. In the chill of night, at the scene of a crime, like a street of night.
But there we are. Right, so, is there anything else we've got to say? You mentioned the Master, of course, but we'll have to do a Master episode one day. Two returning villains always throughout most of the Pertwee era. One was either the Master or it's permanent Under Secretary of State turning up. Hayden, which Doctor are we having next?
Right, okay. So we've got a choice. We've got three. We've got David Tennant, Patrick Troughton, and Colin Baker, who haven't been drawn out yet. And we're going to hold Peter Capaldi till the end, aren't we, chaps? Because we did the vote for that, but the listeners didn't. Okay, come on. Right, I'm a bit stuck here because I only like one of the eras that's left, so... Okay.
It's David Tennant, isn't it?
Well, it's not DT, is it?
Yeah, it is.
Oh my God, it's the only one who's got an era almost as long as... So.
Well, you don't have to watch them all, dog. You just do them from memory if need be, you know.
That's right.
I'm so pleased I'm surrounded by people of a like mind. I really am.
Right, in that case... Oh, here come the Sons of Skara. Dalek Skaros, do you have a message for us about the upcoming promised lifting of the COVID lockdown?
Emergency regulations. Please do not dump bodies into the river.
Dalek Ray, we have anti-Dalek Force ships in Sector
27. It's a trap!
Bye-bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
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 I cross the void beyond the mind, the empty space that circles time. I see where others stumble blind, seek a truth they never find. Eternal wisdom is my guide. I am the Doctor. Through cosmic waste the TARDIS flies, to taste the secret source of life. A present science can't deny exists within, outside, behind the latitude of the human mind. Dissect the course of time. Who knows, you say, but are you right? Who searches deep to find the light that glows so darkly in the night? Toward that point, I guide my flight. As fingers move to end mankind, metallic teeth begin their grind. With sword of truth, I turn to fight the satanic powers of the night. Is your faith before your mind? No, man, am I the Doctor?
You have been listening to the Diddly Dum Podcast. Find us on our blog at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com, on iTunes, Facebook, Audioboo, and Stitcher.com at diddlydum, on Twitter at diddly_dum, or email us at diddlydumpodcast@yahoo.co.uk. Diddly Dum. Meaty, not runny. Top breeders recommend it because it's solid nourishment for the ears.